Welcome back to Crime Ghoul, a true crime podcast where I'm your host, Brittany, and I'm happy to be here with the cutest Bat Piggy co-host ever, my Frenchton pup, Kylo. If you're new here, you will hear me talk about Kylo from time to time as he is my emotional support and he's just the cutest dog out there. He's a French Bulldog Boston Terrier mix and yeah, he's perfect. So we're ready to kick off season two and give you the deets on a true crime case that has horrified the nation. And I'm sure some of you in the true crime community already know so much about this case, but I'm sure there are some of you who only know the surface level details. So I'm here to give you an extensive look at this true crime case while it continues to unravel in real time. After this episode, I will be sure to provide you with all of the updates and details as they come. If you're new here, thank you so much for joining me. Welcome to Crime Ghoul. I love talking about true crime, and yeah, if you like that, you're in the perfect place. But just remember that we are talking about crime, so this can get a little nitty gritty, there can be some disturbing details, and I do provide trigger warnings, but basically, every episode should come with a trigger warning because this is upsetting material. So there's that. So, without further ado, go brew yourself a cup of coffee, pour yourself a glass of wine, or perhaps take a shot of whiskey, because these true crime cases are not for the faint of heart. As always, thank you so much for listening. I'm sure it seems like a nightmare. Hell, I think we as a nation wished for it to be a nightmare. But unfortunately, it wasn't. It very much happened. Four University of Idaho students were stabbed to death in their college off-campus home located at 1122 King Road in Musco, Idaho. To tell this story, we have to reverse the clock. We need to go back to the night of November 12th, 2022. So five students lived in this off-campus house together. They lived in a cul-de-sac known by the local students as Fratlantis, which gets me every time because that's just the funniest name. But this cul-de-sac is home to off-campus Greek life residents. This King Road house in particular had quite the reputation. Really, it had quite the legacy. You see, before our five main roommates lived there, it was inhabited by a lineage of other Greek life students. So house parties have been held at this place for years. And every year this house was expected to host these huge banger parties, and 2022 was no exception to that. In 2022, the following individuals lived in the house, and these are going to be our main players and, key players in today's episode. So there's 21-year-old Kaylee Gonsalves, 21-year-old Madison Mogan, 20-year-old Zanna Kernodle, 21-year-old Bethany Funk, and 21-year-old Dylan Mortensen. And then there is one other player here who did not live at the King Road residence, but might as well have, because he was dating Zanna Kernodle, and that was 20-year-old Ethan Chapin. And within hours, four of these university students would be dead. So the crime itself took place in the early hours of November 12th. So we have to rewind the clock a few hours prior. We have to go to November 11th, which was a quintessential college Friday night. It's the kind of college nights that so many students wish to have. Halloween had just passed and Thanksgiving was right around the corner. Crunchy fall leaves would cover the ground, colored red, orange, yellow, and brown. There were probably still a few remaining on the trees. And when I think of this type of ambiance, I think of the candle sweater weather from Bath & Body Works. It's that type of atmosphere, that vibe, and if you know, you know. If you don't, go to Bath & Body Works and go smell a candle. No, this is not sponsored. You see, Musco, Idaho was a college town. The university was the heart of the city, and this night was important because it was the last home football game of the season. And if you were there that night, you would probably feel the brisk autumn night, a slight chill in the air. You would hear echoes of the university marching band, roars from the crowd in the stadium, and drunken college kids just having fun at their tailgates. You'd probably notice a sea of yellow and black as the students and locals were representing their team. Many of them would be wearing merch that says, "Go Vandals," and that's the school mascot. All seemed right in the world. College football nights, the fall quintessential America, you know, it's what college dreams are made of. But unfortunately, the Vandals did not win that night. But that didn't stop the town from being in good spirits. Musco's popular motto for a football game loss was, "So what if we lose, we still got booze," which I really like that motto, just saying. University of Idaho was ranked as the best party school in the state, and it showed. So that's kind of a tidbit of information about, like, what was going on campus that night. Our timeline really takes place in the evening, 8 p.m. to be exact. At this point, Kaylee Gonsalves posted a picture that has become an infamous Instagram post, and it's forever frozen in time. She was showcasing her love for her roommates and her friend Ethan Chapin. The friends are pictured standing together, and they all look so happy. Dylan is taller than the other girls, looking smiley while standing next to Kaylee. Madison, also known as Maddie, is sitting on Kaylee's shoulders. Kaylee and Maddie are both blonde beauties. You can't help but notice Kaylee's radiant smile and Maddie's cute smile with her scrunched up button nose. Then there's tall Ethan with his warm smile and his arm around his tiny girlfriend Zanna, who is standing right next to another blonde beauty, Bethany. The caption reads, "One lucky girl to be surrounded by these people every day. They all seem close and happy." It's a college memory captured and uploaded to the gram. Some of the timeline prior to 8 p.m. is murky. We don't really know if all of these friends slash roommates went to the football game together or not. There's a lot of conflicting information out there. But what we do know is around 8 o'clock, they were split up. They weren't together. They were kind of off in pairs almost. Kaylee and Maddie decided to hit the very well-known Corner Club, which is a sports bar in town. Ethan had gone to the Betty's Ball with his sister, and this was an event held by his sister's sorority. After the ball, Ethan met up with Zanna at a party thrown by his own fraternity, Sigma Chi. Bethany was also at the frat party that night and later reported that she saw both Ethan and Zanna. Dylan allegedly was out in Musco that night, but we don't have specific details of what she was doing. And I mean, same for Bethany. Like, we know that she was at the Sigma Chi party, but we don't really know much else other than that. So from 10:30 p.m. to around 2 a.m., Kaylee and Maddie were at the bar. They spent a majority of their time at the Corner Club with friends, and then they left. On their way home, they stopped at a local food truck known as the Grub Truck, and they ordered some carbonara pasta, and they made their way home in a ride-sharing vehicle. Kaylee and Maddie were forever a package deal. The two had beautiful smiles and a great sense of fashion. They also had these wonderful personalities and great intelligence. They had been super close since the sixth grade. Both were now seniors in college, and they were holding on to every second remaining of their college experience before it was gone and they had to venture out into the real world. But despite holding on, the girls were ready to take on the world. Kaylee was just barely living at their home on King Road anymore. You see, she had a job lined up and waiting for her in Texas, where she would begin her life separate from her closest friend. And this would actually be the first time that the two had been apart in a very long time. Kaylee was graduating early. She was set to walk at the December commencement ceremony, whereas Maddie was set to graduate in the spring. Both of the girls' lives were blooming, and a new path was being paved. Kaylee had just bought a new Range Rover all on her own, and this was her dream car. She saved and saved for this car, and she worked, and she got it. Kaylee was proud of her first big purchase, and that day on November 11th, Kaylee returned to Musco to visit Maddie and stay the weekend at their off-campus apartment. She wanted to show her friend her new car. Maddie and junior student Zanna Kernodle were part of the same sorority. They were powering through the year. Zanna was this petite, beautiful, and kind brunette girl, and Maddie and Zanna both worked at a local restaurant known as the Mad Greek. Zanna was head over heels in love with her boyfriend Ethan, and he felt the same way about her. Ethan was tall and athletic and known to be super friendly. He is actually one of three triplets. He has a brother and sister, and they all attended the University of Idaho together, and they were all part of Greek life. Ethan was extremely close to his friends and family. He was known as a gentle giant and even referred to as a teddy bear. Then there's Dylan Mortensen and Bethany Funk. Bethany was actually Maddie's little, and Maddie was her big. If you don't know what that means, that's completely okay, because I don't know all this jargon either, because I was never part of Greek life, but this is just like sorority talk. And basically, a big takes on a little, which is usually a freshman member of the sorority. And the big mentors the little. This group was heavily affiliated with Greek life, and the girls were all really close. They loved making TikTok videos together. So by 2 a.m., all of our roommates and Ethan Chapin were inside of the King Road residence. By this time, they were likely winding down from a long day and night filled with fun and good vibes. So, before we get into any more details, we need to understand the layout of the house. This house had three floors. On the third floor is where you would find Kaylee's room and Maddie's room right across. Kaylee and Maddie were both in Maddie's room that night. Then on the second floor is where you would find the kitchen and common space. You would also find a sliding glass door that leads to an outside balcony. On this floor, you also find Dylan's bedroom and Zanna's bedroom. That night, Ethan was in Zanna's bedroom with her. He often slept over. So that's to better understand where everybody was in the house that night. And just a little detail to add, Zanna and Ethan started dating in the spring of 2022. They hadn't been together long, but friends stated that they were meant for each other and they shared a beautiful relationship, and they were very much in love. Finally, on the first floor is where you would find Bethany Funk's room. Although we don't know everything that went on inside of the house that night, we do know that most of the roommates did not go to sleep right away. Kaylee was making phone calls to an ex-boyfriend named Jack. These calls continued until a little after 2 a.m. Jack lived nearby. He was just a rock's throw away from their residence. He and Kaylee shared a golden doodle named Murphy. Murphy had been sleeping in Kaylee's room that night. Zanna ordered DoorDash, and that was dropped off around 4 a.m., and it was reported that she had been using TikTok until about 4:12 a.m. So sometime between 4 a.m. and 4:25 a.m., something absolutely nightmarish happens. Within this 25-minute time span, 4 out of 6 people would be brutally stabbed to death. Just about 8 hours go by before a 911 call is placed. Mind you, this call has yet to be released to the public, but here's what we know. A 911 dispatcher answers a call in which they speak to multiple people. What is communicated to the dispatcher is that there is an unconscious person at the King Road residence. Allegedly, Musco 911 calls were routed to Pullman, Washington, which was just 10 miles away. These calls are routed there due to severely understaffed dispatch crews, which I'm sure you can understand that this sounds a little crazy. This has actually become a public safety concern due to the large amount of residents within Musco and Pullman. Thus, the dispatch crews would spare no time probing agitated 911 callers for details. Instead, they assigned a generic explanation for police dispatch such as unconscious person, which needless to say, this is not the best way to save time. And here's why. Because police thought they were pulling up to a house that had unconscious people or an unconscious person, not a quadruple homicide. So the police were dispatched, and within minutes, there were sirens blaring and lights flashing as 3 cop cars pulled up to the house on King Road. Police would step out of their cars and notice a sea of silent, what they presumed to be, university students. They were all standing in front of the house, and the silence actually shocked the officers because it seemed so unnatural. Usually when you have a group of students, they're talking amongst each other, they're giggling, like there's sound, but here it was just a group of people and silence. The cluster of young folks appeared drained and even shocked. Officers felt something was very wrong. As they approached the front door, only one word was spoken from the crowd. Dead. An officer walked into the house and his nostrils were immediately engulfed by a strong metallic rust smell. The officer would soon realize why. He was smelling the blood of 4 murdered students. The scene was chaotic and there was a lot of blood. Media outlets quickly snapped a photo outside of the house where blood could be seen dripping down the side of the house. The police were stunned. They thought they were walking into an unconscious person situation, not a quadruple homicide. See, there's the problem. So the officers observed blood-streaked floors and they found the deceased bodies of Ethan and Zanna in her bedroom. Then they found the deceased bodies of Kaylee and Maddie in Maddie's bedroom. Some observations were noted. Kaylee's wounds were more severe than any of the other victims. She had very deep lacerations. Zanna appeared to have put up a fight. She suffered from wounds to her hands and fingers, and some people would even say that her fingers were almost completely severed. Police then located a happy labradoodle named Murphy in Kaylee's room. He had no injuries, not even a speck of blood. So why did Kaylee have more severe wounds than everybody else? And poor Zanna. I mean, she's a strong individual. Those were obviously defense wounds, and she put up one hell of a fight. The events split up into multiple branches from here, and I'm sure you have a lot of questions. But I hate to tell you, some of those questions have yet to be answered, and who knows if they ever will. But try to follow closely because it could become rather confusing. Residents of Musco were horrified as they got word that 4 students were murdered in their beds while sleeping. Many friends of the four were trying to make sense of the situation, but they say it actually made no sense at all, none of it. A close friend of Kaylee stated that although the house is known as a party house, and there was a lot of foot traffic all the time, everyone knew everyone, so if a stranger had been to one of the parties or had been to the residence, surely this person would have been noticed. So could the killer have been someone they knew? It just wasn't making sense. Who would kill these four amazing people who were known to be some of the nicest people around? People were also wondering how four people could be viciously murdered and two come out alive and untouched. People started to realize the gap in time before police were called. So what was that about? Media outlets speculated about the two surviving roommates, as did Reddit, Twitter, and creators on YouTube. People were stumped. How could two roommates obliviously sleep through such carnage? Many people came to their defense, recounting their own memories of curling up into bed after a long night of partying. And we will discuss this more as we get further into the story. As details continue to emerge, people all over the nation and world would learn that police did not locate a weapon at the home. Officers quickly notified the public that they did not believe there was an immediate threat and that the murders were believed to be a targeted attack. Which, this was retracted multiple times. The police were kind of all over the place. One minute they're saying there's no threat, next minute there is a threat. It was just a little chaotic. So many residents questioned this and they felt outraged that there was a killer on the loose. After all, Musco was safe. It was cozy. It was known for its art and local artists. It was known for wheat production, for crying out loud. How could four vibrant people be killed and their lives cut so short in such a horrific manner? News would continue to travel, and eventually it would come out that one surviving roommate saw something disturbing that night. She also claimed to hear noises. In a publicly released affidavit, Dylan Mortensen would state that she peeked out of her bedroom multiple times in the wee hours of November 12th. At first, she was woken up by noises. She thought that she heard Kaylee upstairs playing with Murphy. Then she thought she heard Kaylee say, "Someone is here." Dylan would peek out of her door and she said that she didn't see anything. Then she reported that she heard what sounded like whimpering coming from Zana's bedroom. Then she heard a male voice that said, "Don't worry, I'm going to help you." She would look out her door a final time and state that she saw a man dressed in all black. He had a mask covering his mouth and nose. He was about 5'10 and had an athletic build. He also had bushy eyebrows. She would state that he walked right past her door to the sliding glass door at the back of the house. Dylan stated that she stood there in a frozen shock phase and eventually locked her bedroom door until the morning. Many people have grown frustrated with this information. They had trouble understanding how Dylan did not call the police or how she did not go to check on her friends. It's hard to know for sure because obviously we don't have all the information. Perhaps one day this will all make more sense. Maybe it won't. Many people want to know who spoke to the 911 operator, and they want to know what was said. It's rare for a 911 call to be withheld from the public, but in this case, the prosecution is keeping this tight to their chest. Allegedly, Dylan and Bethany were unable to wake up their roommates. They phoned some friends who quickly came over, then one of their phones was used to call 911, and multiple people spoke to the operator. This case quickly became a media frenzy. It engulfed national news. And I think it's because this could be any parent's worst nightmare, especially parents who have children away at university. It could also be any of our best friends or any of our siblings. It truly has gripped the hearts of so many people, and it's a case I know I can't get off of my mind. After the murders, students quickly vacated the premises, leaving Musco like a ghost town. People felt really scared and unsafe. FBI agents arrived the day after the murders. 40 agents were present. Three specifically from the Behavioral Analysis Unit. So here are the facts of the case so far. The four students were attacked somewhere between 4 and 4:25. There was no sign of forced entry or robbery. A single weapon had been used, a long-bladed knife believed to be a K-bar knife. A tan leather knife sheath was found on the bed next to, slash under, Maddie Mogan. The sheath was stamped with a Marine insignia. There was no trail of blood found outside of the house. And a lot of forensic evidence was taken from the house. Blood, saliva, hair, fingerprints, and DNA. The media descended upon this case like crazy, like vultures. The rumor mill took over on social media. And besides the Gabby Petito case, this is one of the first major crime cases of the social media age. Some web sleuths overstepped their boundaries and began accusing several people, such as Kaylee's ex-boyfriend Jack. The Gonsalves family were quick to come to his defense and supported his innocence. One TikToker even accused a university professor of being the killer, and the professor sued the TikToker. It was getting pretty rough out there. The Gonsalves family has been extremely vocal and they refuse to let the light dim on this case. Kaylee's older sister Olivia acted fast and was able to recover footage from the grub truck the night of the murders. She was able to find out information about the ride sharing as well. It wasn't an Uber or a Lyft. It was, you know, some type of ride sharing that goes on between the Greek life students or university students. So Olivia was on this case. She spared no time and she jumped right into action. And as a big sister myself, I know if this were my siblings, I would be solving the case. I'd be figuring it out. I really would be crazy. So, you know, Olivia, I totally understand why she jumped into it. So it turns out the grub truck had a live stream that night, and we were able to peer into the final hours of Kaylee and Maddie's life. This led to a lot of speculation and close examination of the people who were featured in that live stream. There was one guy in the background who would quickly become known as Hoodie Guy, and he was targeted by the public immediately. So in the video, you could see the girls heading up to the grub truck, and there's a guy who's kind of like behind them. You don't really know right off the bat if he's with them, but then you kind of hope he is because he's just hovering around them closely and he puts his hood up over his hat. But needless to say, this was just one of their friends who was walking them to the grub truck and was supposed to walk them home after they got like food from the truck. So with media speculating and dissecting that video, the police came out quickly clearing Hoodie Guy and Jack as suspects. They also cleared a few other people, and the public was confused as to how the police were so quick to clear these individuals. But what we didn't know at the time was that they were already on to someone. They were on to a doctoral student at a local college, Washington State University to be exact, and you'll never believe his major. Criminology. Like, really? So how did they hone in on this person and who is it? Before we get into that, there's just one detail I left out. There was also like this surveillance like footage piece that was going around, and you could see Maddie and Kaylee walking home, and it's Kaylee saying, "What did you say to Adam?" And she's talking to Maddie, and then Maddie's like, "I told him everything." So that also caused crazy wild speculation because everybody's like, what did they tell Adam? Who's Adam? Adam just so happens to be their friend who works at the corner club. He's a bartender. We still don't really know what that context means, like what the context of the video was, what Adam knows, what he doesn't know. But I don't know that it's very important. A lot of people just stick to it and they're like, oh, this means something. You know, they're talking about this right before they get murdered, like, and you know, Kaylee seems pretty upset about it, but who knows? It could have been anything, and we don't have that information, so I'm not sure if it's worth holding on to or not, but I feel like it's worth mentioning just in case. So as the days and weeks unfolded after the murders, police were asking for tips that may help their investigation. A woman who worked at a local gas station, the assistant manager, decided to go through some surveillance footage from that night. She was able to find footage of a white sedan speeding by, and guess what? It was right around the time of the murders. And of course, we as the public did not know it then, but the police made a statement and asked the public for tips about a white 2011 to 2013 Hyundai Elantra. So at this point, like, in the public eye, we didn't really know how they had this information about this car, but it slowly trickled out about, you know, the assistant manager of this gas station finding the surveillance footage. So it turns out they had footage from the King Road neighborhood as well, because of course police talked to the residents and the neighbors, and they wanted everything that they could get. So in that footage, they could also see this white sedan. So they sent this to FBI headquarters, which is in Quantico, Virginia, for further analysis, and they deduced that it was a 2011 to 2013 white Hyundai Elantra. But unfortunately, this footage did not capture a license plate, and it was too pixelated to catch an image of the driver. But it turns out that there were about 22,000 people in the area of Pullman and Moscow who were registered to have that car make and model. So the police were about to do a lot of digging when all of a sudden a Washington State University police officer brought over some very helpful information. He claimed that they had a student registered at the university with a 2015 white Hyundai Elantra. So this wasn't the year that they were looking for in particular, but they still looked into it. And they found that the car belonged to a 28-year-old PhD student and teacher's assistant named Brian Christopher Koberger. He lived just 8 miles away from the crime scene, and he matched the description of the suspect in the murders, right down to the bushy eyebrows. So, police also found that his car was originally registered in Pennsylvania, and he had just registered it within the state of Washington. So, this is interesting. They took a closer look at Brian, and they found that he had been in a traffic stop just months prior. And at the time, he had given the officer his cell phone number. So, they were able to get that phone number, use it, and obtain cellular data that showed that Brian had been in the vicinity of the Muskow home that fateful night. In fact, throughout that year, he had been near the home on several occasions. So his phone just so happened to lose signal before the murders that night, and it regained signal not long after the murders. The data was also pinned near the residence around 9:40 a.m. that morning after the murders, which was before the police were called by the students. So the only problem with this cell phone evidence is that the cell phone tower range can go up to 14 miles. So that's a pretty wide net, and a lot of people could be pinned off that tower. So this evidence isn't like the most reliable, because who's to say he wasn't doing some other things? It's not like he was showing up like super close, like on the block. It was just like in Muskow in the vicinity. I mean, it would be one thing if he showed up on like their Wi-Fi, which was a rumor that was going around. I believe Steve Gonsalves shared that information that he like showed up on the Wi-Fi, but there was actually no evidence of that. So maybe that's true, maybe it's not, maybe that's just information that wasn't supposed to be released to the public, but I guess we'll find out. As weeks went on, more evidence was found. That knife sheath would become a huge clue in this case, and after careful examination, male touch DNA had been discovered on the button of the knife sheath. The FBI followed the lead they had, and in fact, they followed Brian all the way home to retrieve possible DNA. Police kept this information under wraps. Winter break arrived, and they followed Brian all the way to his family home in Pennsylvania. Koberger was unaware of this the whole time. His father, Michael Koberger, flew from Pennsylvania to Seattle to meet Brian so they could drive cross-country back home to celebrate the holiday season with their family. And a lot of us are guessing that Michael wanted to join Brian on this ride because it was such a long ride. Like, he is driving across country. So, not sure if that's completely accurate. We don't really know the details there, but there's a lot of speculation about that. So I'm sure his father could never have guessed that this might be the last holiday season he and his family would spend with Brian. The Kobergers took a longer route home than like your normal route. So they made it a little more complicated. They could have done like a straight route, but they ended up, you know, like deviating from this. So later it was stated that they rerouted, due to bad weather on their first route, because it was snowing and there was really bad weather. So during their long drive home, Brian was pulled over twice for tailgating, driving too close to other cars. So I don't know if this guy's just like a shitty driver, but he has been like pulled over multiple times. But I feel like the interesting thing is like he's able to talk his way out of it. So right at the start of winter break, Brian receives an alert from Washington State University. So I guess this happened like right when they were leaving the university to go home, or maybe it was like a few days prior, but whatever. Needless to say, he gets that text message alert, and the community was advised to shelter in place. The Kobergers would learn by listening to news reports that earlier that evening, a man menacingly waving a rifle had threatened to kill his roommates. When the police arrived, the frightened roommates were released, but the guy with the rifle, whose name was Brent Kopaka, a 36-year-old Army veteran who was reportedly suffering from PTSD, had barricaded himself in their apartment, and he made it clear he wasn't going to leave. So local police approached and SWAT team approached. Kopaka opened fire at law enforcement, and they shot back. After a 7-hour-long standoff with the SWAT team, the sergeant shot Kopaka dead. So, this bit of information might be important, it might not be important. I think the point of sharing this is just the reason why I'm sharing a lot of things is because it could be related, it could not be related. There's a lot of speculation going on. The only thing I could do is report the facts. I'm trying not to make any, like, you know, connections here, because the fact of the matter is we just don't have enough information to do so. But a lot of people speculate that Brett Kopaka was somehow involved with this Muskow, Idaho situation, and somehow Brian Koberger was as well. I don't know if any of that's true, but needless to say, Musco and Pullman are very quiet towns, and all of a sudden, within November and December, you've got 4 university students slaughtered, and then you've got this guy who's wielding his rifle and threatening to kill his roommates. And it's also from, you know, the area where Brian's from. So I get why people are, like, wondering if all of these things are connected, because, you know, this just doesn't happen in this area. Like, it's a quiet place. It's a happy place. So yeah, it's just worth mentioning. But it makes you wonder what the Kobergers talked about during their long drive all the way back to Pennsylvania. You know, like I said, you've got those students who were murdered, and then you've got this crazy rifle-wielding man. I don't want to say crazy, maybe that's not the right word. You know, he was suffering from PTSD, but you've got this guy who's, you know, acting in a very scary manner. So you have to think that Michael Koberger probably was asking his son about it, right? Like, how do you not talk about these things? Like, oh, hey, son, like, what'd you think about those poor students that were murdered? Did you know any of them? Did you know anyone who knew them? Or it's like the same with Kopaka, like, this guy wielding his rifle. Like, it's just a lot going on in that area. How do you guys not talk about it? Especially because the Musco students made international news, so everybody knew about it. So deep in the woods of Pennsylvania, the FBI would follow Brian to his house. They lived in a white colonial house in Albrightsville, Pennsylvania. The FBI would need to obtain a DNA sample to try to compare it to the DNA that was found on the knife sheath. So legally, they can take the trash of the Koberger residence once they discard their trash. So on December 27th, they did just that. They were able to obtain male DNA from the Kobergers' garbage. They obtained DNA that belonged to Michael Koberger, and they did a genealogy test and found that it was a close enough match to file an arrest warrant against Brian. Law enforcement observed the following while they were watching Brian. They saw that he took his Hyundai in for a servicing in a garage in Effort, Pennsylvania, which is not far from his parents' home. I guess that's not so weird. I mean, he did just make a cross-country trip, so that's a lot of miles to put on your car and a lot of wear and tear. But next, he was spotted wearing gloves as he gave his car meticulous cleaning. I mean, maybe this could be weird. I don't know. I've seen people wear gloves when they clean their car. I don't know. Some people are very sensitive to chemicals, so I wouldn't be surprised, like, if he did do this. Like, I don't know if it's that much of a red flag. But then they also watched him sneak over to deposit some trash in a neighbor's garbage pail at around 4 a.m. one morning. And now I think that's freaking sketchy. That's weird. But I don't know. Could he have been, like, hiding something in the garbage, like, that he didn't want his family to know he threw out? Or could it be related to the Musco murders? Not sure. So make of that what you will. So just after midnight on December 30th, a SWAT team smashed into the Koberger residence, and they arrested Brian in connection with the murders. His family was stunned. People who knew him were stunned. People who knew the Kobergers sent in tips to the police, and some even came out on TikTok. There were people who went to school with Brian. There was, school and college. And then there were people who were friends with him, people who went on dates with him. His hairdresser, for Christ's sakes, came out and talked about it. So just a lot of people were stunned. A lot of people remembered him as kind of weird, but never thought he'd be capable of this. So Brian was a person who struggled in his adolescence. He was overweight and he wasn't well liked by his peers. He was known for being socially awkward, and his awkwardness followed him into his adulthood. Brian struggled with heroin for a few years, but he eventually turned his life around. He went to rehab and he got help. Then he went to college, and in 2020, he actually graduated from DeSales University in Allentown, Pennsylvania. He graduated with a master's degree in criminal justice. And when Koberger was caught, he was working towards his PhD in criminology at Washington State University. He worked as a teacher's assistant while at WSU. And oddly enough, he was reportedly fired in the weeks prior to his arrest from being a teacher's assistant. The university investigated him for run-ins with the professor and his behavior towards women, and it was found that he was rude and boorish to students and peers. There were a few students that even came forward and said that he was an extremely harsh grader, but when they looked back and thought about it, he all of a sudden became more lenient around the times of the murders. So that's weird. So, despite Brian's social challenges, he was known to be a good student. He learned a lot, and this is probably why people feel so uneasy about him. Because Brian knows a lot about the criminal mind and how it works. He knows a lot about crime scene investigation, and when he was at DeSales University, he learned all about crime scenes. He had even been in a mock crime scene house for learning purposes. And as he moved on to work on his PhD, he is remembered by his master's thesis supervisor and advisor, Professor Michelle Bolger, as a bright student. She stated that she had only ever recommended one other student to a PhD program. She stated that Brian was one of the best students she ever had. And ironically, while he was attending WSU, he applied for an internship at the Pullman Police Department. That's right, the police department that's only 10 miles away from Musco, and the police department that gets Musco's phone calls. So in his application essay, he stated that he wanted to assist the police department in better collecting and analyzing technological data in public safety operations. So basically, he wanted to help better gather evidence by pulling surveillance footage, checking out cell phones that pinged off nearby towers as a crime had gone down, and by running revocatory license plate numbers through the all-knowing law enforcement computer systems. So this is a little ironic. I don't know what you guys think, but it's a little ironic, and that's because everything he wanted to do for the Pullman Police Department is exactly how they caught him. So I'll just let that sink in. It's irony. It's funny, if you ask me. Like, not really funny, but it's weird. So, police started unraveling more information as they were digging, and they were learning more about Brian and who he was when he was younger, and even into, like, you know, his college years. But they found that Brian had made an interesting Reddit post years prior. He had put out an anonymous questionnaire, and he invited convicts to assist him in research for school. It said, "I am inviting you to participate in a research project that seeks to understand how emotions and psychological traits influence decision-making when committing a crime. In particular, the study seeks to understand the story behind your most recent arrest, with an emphasis on your thoughts and your feelings throughout your experience." So many people online have wondered if this was an honest request for research purposes, or was this perhaps a future killer looking for pointers? Again, I don't know, make of that what you will, people. But needless to say, Brian has been charged with 4 counts of first-degree murder and burglary. From the get-go, Brian has claimed his innocence, and his first attorney stated that Brian was looking forward to being exonerated. As weeks and months went by, more and more information had been trickling into the public sphere about Brian. So Brian had been in the King Road neighborhood near the murder site at least a dozen times over the past few months, and many couldn't help but wonder if he had been stalking one of the victims, or the residents in general. Koberger also had turned off his phone during the time when the murders occurred. So again, lots of red flags here, man. And then a post that he made on a website called Tapatalk resurfaced, and this was a post that he made as a teenager. So the then teenager Brian highlighted his unhappiness and alienation. So these feelings had led him to contemplate suicide, and he described these feelings as painful demons that drove him to search for a sort of relief by mainlining heroin. He then shared that he suffers from what he believes to be visual snow. And if you guys don't know what visual snow is, it's a rare but very real and chronic neurological condition. And to those who suffer from it, the world is viewed through a glass darkly. It's like looking at a television screen and the picture's fluttering or fuzzy. The image is obscured by amorphous grayish waves and scattered flickering dots. So you know what I mean. It's like when the TV would lose cable and it would look like it was snow on the screen. That's kind of what these people experience. But we don't know if it's a disease or if it's a psychological condition. And doctors, according to the very little research that there is available, they throw up their hands in frustration and confusion because they have no idea, like, if this is a real disease or if it's like a psychologically, you know, motivated type of thing. So you could diagnose visual snow, but it's really hard to treat. I mean, if you had to ask me, I'm not an expert, but I feel like it's more of a psychological thing, and it's probably like trauma or stress induced. But needless to say, he continued to state in his post on Tapatalk that, "I often think of myself as an organic sack of meat with no self-worth, and I'm starting to view everyone as this. I always feel as if I'm not there. I'm completely depersonalized. constant thought of suicide, crazy thoughts, delusions of grandeur, and poor self-image. No emotion. I feel like nothing has a point to it. Everyone hates me. Pretty much I'm an asshole. And as I hug my family, I see nothing. It's like I'm looking at a video game, but less. So once Koberger was arrested, this hit the media like a storm. Everybody knew about it. Everybody was very curious about who this person was, and web sleuths were doing a lot of research and digging. So we would learn that Brian Koberger's father is Michael and his mother is Marianne. Michael and Marianne had three children together, two daughters and a son. Their eldest daughter is Amanda, and their second daughter is Melissa, and then there's Brian, who's the youngest. And the family lived in and around Monroe County, Pennsylvania for years. And there's another interesting tidbit. There was a 45-year-old woman in Monroe County named Dana Smithers who disappeared and was later found dead. So they called Brian's parents to testify, wondering if he had some relation to this murder. But they have no evidence linking Brian to this crime. Both Michael and Mary Ann work in the same school district in Broadsville, Pennsylvania. Michael is a maintenance worker, and Mary Ann was working as a paraprofessional. As for Brian's siblings, Melissa is said to be a mental health therapist working in New Jersey, and not much is known about Amanda other than she appeared in a 2011 horror film. So this was like a low budget, like student-made film, but it just so happens to be about a group of students who were stabbed to death, so I don't know what you think about that, but that's pretty interesting as well. I also think it's interesting that apparently Marianne was very outspoken in her community, and she would write to the Pocono Record. And one thing she wrote about with such passion was about the Uvalde massacre, in which a gunman named Salvador Ramos fatally shot 19 students and 2 4th grade teachers back in 2022 at Robb Elementary School in Uvalde, Texas. So you guys probably remember that case because that was a really well-known case as well. So I think it's very interesting how outspoken she was. She also expressed her opposition of the death penalty and abortion at the Pocono Record. So she would write in a lot and it would be like kind of publicized. So I wonder if this is where Brian got his interest in like crime, and I'm talking about like the shootings, like the school shootings, and then also her, you know, feelings about the death penalty. So I wonder if that's how Brian got interested in the criminal justice field, because she seems to be very vocal about her feelings. So, interesting. So of course the families of the victims were happy for an arrest, but of course that will never bring their children back, or their siblings back, or their friends back. They know that there is a long road ahead before they get any type of justice, especially because Brian took a silent plea in which a judge entered him into a plea of not guilty. The Gonsalves family have been extremely vocal for Kaylee and Maddie, and the Gonsalveses were extremely close with Maddie, stating that she was family too. Kaylee's parents, Christy and Steve, and Kaylee's sister Olivia have made sure that the light does not dim on this case. Kaylee also has other siblings who have been a little more quiet in the mainstream media, but nonetheless, they're there. Kaylee was one of five siblings. Olivia was on this case immediately, like I said before, and Steve and Christy quickly took media opportunities to share any information that they could. Steve has made comments in the past about the killer possibly knowing Kaylee and Maddie from Instagram, and the Gonsalves parents noted that Kaylee has shared with them that she thought she was being followed by a creepy man while she was in town at a grocery store, but Kaylee never reported this to the university or to police. After hearing about the supposed grocery incident, police looked into it and they found no evidence of a stalker. And you know, Steve has since come forward and said, "All right, well, police said there's no evidence of a stalker. I know my girl was pretty and so were her friends, so they kind of just naturally drew attention." Zanna Kernodle's family has been vocal too. Her father Jeff and her mother Kara have both had their moments in the media. Some of these moments were questionable. It was quickly discovered that Kara has a rap sheet, having been charged with 2 felony counts of drug possession, and she has a history of drug use. Zanna's father talked about the fighter that his daughter was and how proud he was that she put up a fight. There's been a lot of speculation about Kara Kernodle Northington, Zanna's mother, because of her relation to drugs. One of the big rumors going around is that this group that lived at this house on King Road had some type of affiliation with drugs and possibly flushed a lot of money worth of drugs down the toilet, and there was a hit put out on them because they owed like $200,000 or something like this. So please be cautious when you're on these online forums, whether it's Reddit, 4chan, or you're on YouTube listening to some sleuthers talk about this, because it's not necessarily true. And we won't know if there's any connection like this. I know it's very easy to speculate and it's easy to go down the rabbit hole, but just remember that these people are human beings and we don't want to over-speculate or spread any false information or rumors that could harm the case. And plus, I know Ethan's mom has come out and said in interviews that there were no drugs involved, nothing like that, and she was pretty pissed off about the rumor. So I'm not sure. Ethan Chapin's family has spoken to the media as well, and his parents are very vocal about how they want to tell their son's story, and that there's people who are getting book deals and people who don't know their son who are speaking on his behalf, and that makes them very upset. So I'm not going to say too much about Ethan. I would never want to overstep that boundary, but I do think it's good to talk about these victims because they're real people. And the reason we talk about these cases is so we learn and understand like what goes on, and so history doesn't repeat itself. So even though we don't have all the facts of the information, there's a reason we talk about these true crime cases. So there are a few things that I think are worth mentioning from the Chapins, and it's just to talk about how influential Ethan was in other people's lives and the kindness and the goodness that he spread, which all of these individuals, all these, like these victims specifically, spread this type of vibe. But you know, with Ethan's parents, I know they've been very hesitant to take on the media and talk on the media because, you know, I'm sure this is a very difficult time for them. So the two things I'm going to talk about are Ethan's Smile, which is a very nice program, and this is from Tulip Valley Farms. So what is Ethan's Smile? This is a tulip bulb mix, and it's a tribute and legacy of the light and goodness of Ethan Chapin. And all proceeds of this mix support the planting of Ethan's Smile gardens at the University of Idaho and in Mount Vernon, and are donated causes in memoriam of Ethan. So I'm gonna leave a link in the show notes so you can go purchase some of this mix and contribute to that if you'd like. I know it means a lot to the family, so I'm really glad that we got to mention this. You know, Tulip Valley Farms is a place that Ethan worked seasonally and he loved it there. And obviously, this is a way for that community to remember their friend and their teammate and family member. But Stacy Chapin, Ethan's mom, she wrote a book called The Boy Who Wore Blue, and it's a really good book. It's such a cute read, and this book really does a good job in describing who Ethan was. So if you're interested, this book is for, you know, children 3 years and older, but its message will really resonate with readers of all ages. So here's a little description. So The Boy Who Wore Blue is a story of a happy kid who loves his family, life, and new adventures. He's funny, kind, and inclusive to all, especially his best friends, a triplet brother and sister. The detailed illustrations depict everyday activities and highlight how a sunny disposition and a smile empower us to enjoy life's little moments. So definitely pick up this book. Again, I'll leave this in the show notes as well as any other links that are related to the Idaho 4 and whatever memorials that have been created from their families. There are actually scholarships in memory of Zanna, Ethan, and Maddie, and the university is working with the Gonsalves family to create a fourth scholarship in her name. So these endowed scholarships will help future students as they pursue their educational journeys at the University of Idaho. So with the families taking to the media, it's really a fortunate and unfortunate thing. And I say fortunate because as family members, you want to get involved and you want to do as much as you can to help your loved one and get justice for an injustice. But you want to be careful and tread lightly because you don't want to jeopardize the case. So I say unfortunate because you can tell how badly these families want justice and want to share their thoughts and factual information about the case. But on January 3rd, 2023, the judge of the case at the time, Megan Marshall, issued a gag order restricting comments from prosecutors, the defense, law enforcement, and other officials. However, she was still not satisfied with this, so she worried that she had not successfully dampened down the conversation to ensure a fair trial. Thus, she expanded upon the order to include the survivors and their attorneys, as well as the victims' families and their attorneys. So they're all restricted from speaking to the media. So the media, of course, did not take this lightly, and a lot of the public forums, people were discussing that they were not happy about this. So this quickly headlined in the news outlets. These media organizations worked together to ask for a repeal, and they stated that the gag order impeded the public's understanding of a criminal investigation that profoundly impacted their community. The Gonsalves family attorney, Shannon Gray, agreed with these media organizations, and he believes that the victims' surviving family members are free to speak to the public and the media under the First Amendment of the Constitution, and that their rights to the freedom of speech cannot be restricted through a judicial prior restraint. So there was a change in judge because this case was set to be a preliminary hearing until an indictment went through and pushed this case to move forward to trial. So now Judge, yes, that's right, last name is Judge, he is overseeing this case. And as of June of 2023, Judge revised the gag order. So the revision is as follows. Investigators and law enforcement personnel are no longer identified as being barred from speaking to the media about the November quadruple homicide in Moscow. However, any agents of the prosecuting attorneys and defense attorneys are still bound by the restrictions. So now we wait for a trial. Brian Koberger's defense maintains his innocence, and Brian, like I said earlier, did not verbally plead not guilty. Instead, he exercised his right to remain silent, in which the judge entered him into a plea of not guilty. So there are many reasons why a defendant may do this, and mainly in this case, it's likely that Koberger had a desire to tamp down public outrage. Because, you know, the public is reading into everything, especially when things are televised. They're looking at his facial expressions, he had a little twitch in his jaw. So he likely wanted to avoid pleading out loud due to the received overwhelming publicity and possible accusations made about his physical appearance. So the trial was originally set to begin in October, specifically October 2nd, but this has since been rescheduled because Koberger waived his right to a speedy trial. So Ann Taylor, Koberger's lead public defender, told the court that one of the main factors that influenced this decision was inadequate time for proper legal counsel ahead of the planned October 2nd trial. So the defense wishes to reset the trial date just this one time and not again. They want to get to it, but they want to have enough time to, you know, plead Brian's case. So we wait for the new court date, and until then, let me tell you more about our Idaho 4. So a lot of this information was learned from a memorial that was held for them. Again, I never want to overstep a boundary that upsets the family members, because it is important that they get to tell their loved one's story. Here, like, obviously, like, we're a little disconnected because we don't know these people personally, and I want to respect that, but I do want to honor their memory as well, because they did not deserve to go out this way, and they deserve justice. And if we're going to talk about this case, the most important aspect of this case are the four lives that were so viciously and horribly taken. So here's what we have. So the first bit of information I'm going to give you comes from Jake Schreiger, which is Maddie Mogan's boyfriend. So they had been dating for a year, and you know what he says at the vigil was really cute. But he starts off by talking about Kaylee, actually, who was Maddie's best friend and vice versa. So he talked about how he met Kaylee through Maddie, and he also became closer to Zanna because of Maddie. So he describes Zanna as always being energetic, and Kaylee is strong and driven and kind, and a person who genuinely cared about everyone and their day. He didn't know Ethan well, he didn't meet Ethan many times, but he heard that Ethan was a really great guy. He talked about how he met Maddie her freshman year of college, which is funny because they actually went to the same high school, but because Jake is a few years older, they kind of didn't cross paths when they went to the same high school. So Maddie was part of Pi Phi, and Jake had been friends with the Pi Phi girls before Maddie had come onto campus. So when Maddie came onto campus, the Pi Phi girls took her right under their wing, and they were always there for her. Jake talked about Maddie always being surrounded by good people, like she had really good friends and people who cared about her. So one night, Maddie went out with the Pi Phi girls, and Jake met Maddie this way because he knew those girls. And in the summer of 2020, they actually all went on a trip in the summer. They went boating with the friends and floated down a river, which sounds like a beautiful, like, summer, you know, little vacation getaway with your college friends. And he said that he knew then that he was, like, in love with Maddie. But they would go back to school, and he lived in an apartment that wasn't far off campus, and he would always invite over the Pi Phi girls just to get a chance to hang out with Maddie. He described when he went on his first date with Maddie, and that was on Valentine's Day of 2021, and they went to the Breakfast Club located in Moscow. So by April 27th of that same year, they started dating. He talked about Maddie being a perfectionist, but also being just perfect. He talked about Maddie and Kaylee being 1 month apart and how the two really went all out for each other's birthdays. He said that Maddie would get frustrated because Kaylee would make her birthday perfect for her, and they were always in competition to see who could make the best day for the other. So Maddie spread love to her close ones. She was always smiling, dancing, and laughing. She was observant and pointed out things that were cute, small, and especially pink. She loved being comfy with her comfy socks and her blanket, and she made the best of every situation. She was nice, funny, and confident, and she knew her worth. Jake joked about how he had to work for her, but he said it was worth it. So he said that Maddie knew she was beautiful inside and out, but she was a very humble person. Maddie genuinely cared about close ones, and she genuinely wanted to know about how other people's days were. So like when she asked you how your day was, she wasn't kidding. Like she wanted to know, she cared. And she was also really funny, and her jokes seemed to come out of nowhere. Jake talked about how you'd have to do a double take because this crazy joke would come out of this girl's mouth and you'd be like, is that the cute little blonde girl who just said that? And that was really a big reason as to why he loved her. And he said that she always expressed her love to everyone with words and hugs. He said that Maddie was his best friend and the person he talked to every morning and the last one he talked to every night before bed. He said that she knew him best and helped him through everything. She was always there for him, pushing him to be a better person and to always spread positivity. She was the person he loved the most, and she loved him the most too. I'm going to provide you a clip of Maddie Mogan's dad and how he speaks about her and what he says about her when reminiscing about her life. And it's just one of the cutest things ever.
I had one or two words to describe Maddie Mae. It would be just an angel, and that she just made me proud.
Ben Mogan speaking about his daughter Madison to ABC News and describing the moment law enforcement told him they'd made an arrest in the case.
He said, Ben, this is the day that we've been waiting for.
Ben also describing his emotions while reading the evidence law enforcement say they had gathered against Coburg.
I broke down and I just cried. I could only take so much of that, and I cried. I still haven't read the rest of it. She got these little angel wings. I'm even gonna go in with my sister, and we're gonna get that tattoo together, I think, next week. And it'll be my first tattoo also.
Ben went on to describe that Maddie was the best thing about his life, the best thing that he had ever created, and the best thing he'd ever done with his life. And that just brought me to, like, complete tears, because that's just the sweetest thing. And, you know, Maddie was an only child. Her parents were separated. This is what Maddie's mom and stepdad said. They mentioned her love for water and fishing and boating, and how she loved younger children, especially younger children, because she didn't have siblings. So I think that's really why she gravitated toward Kaylee Gonsalves as well, because Kaylee's one of five, and she always got to hang out with Kaylee's siblings. Maddie also really loved animals and family gatherings. She and Kaylee loved life, and they traveled together, and they loved exploring together. Next is a clip of Steve Gonsalves talking about Kaylee.
Just so I can let everybody know, the main reason I'm up here today is so that everybody can understand what we lost. I hope to be able to make you laugh, but I'm afraid we're going to have to cry, because we lost four beautiful souls, and the two that I'm up here to talk about are the ones I knew. And when I started thinking about how I was going to tell these people what their souls were like and the things that they shared with me, I started thinking that this is going to be really tough. So I did what you guys do. I Googled it. I went in and I looked for the most beautiful things in the world. I looked for some kind of inspiration. I knew I should have took creative writing a lot more serious, because I was in trouble. But I came up with the seven wonders of the world, and I seen them, and I looked at them for inspiration, and I prayed to my girls, and I said, you're gonna have to help me here. I'm struggling. And they just came to me, and they told me there should be another wonder in the world. And I said, all right, help me here. And they said, it's a wonder of the relationship of a father and his daughter. I said, all right, that is pretty wonderful. You start wondering the minute they put that baby in your hand, you wonder what you're going to do. And you wonder how you're going to feed them and how you're going to take care of them. And then you wonder why your wife's yelling at you because you're feeding your baby a hamburger. You know, it's like, and then you wonder, how am I going to understand and make this the best opportunity for both of us? And you start seeing the world through the girl's eyes. And as a father, it's a little bit scary. You start seeing, like, the world starts having, like, this purple haze, and there's puppies, and there's kitties, and there's all these weird movies you have to watch, and they start crying all the time. But you start falling in love with this world that they build. You see this world, and it changes. You don't have pickup trucks and all these footballs. You start seeing the beauty of what they have and what makes them special. So when I was trying to see this world and I was trying to picture what my daughter would want me to say, she would want to say that she loved designer purses and brand new shoes and all these things. So that's the world as I see it now, and I never want to see it any other way. And one of the things is my girls, they gave me a sense like, don't go up there and embarrass us. And I was like, really? All right. And they're like, you just can't be a Chad dad. And I'm like, a Chad dad? But I do think I probably do need to talk to a manager in here for these lighting conditions, because it's not working. So I'm going to embarrass her a little bit, but I want everyone to know these girls were absolutely beautiful. They had been friends since sixth grade. We both put them in a charter academy. They felt like they were being punished. Sixth grade, they just found each other. And every day they did homework together, they came to our house together, they shared everything. They convinced us, they made a proposal to go to high school, to a regular high school. So then they went to high schools together. Then they started looking at colleges, they came here together. They eventually get into the same apartment together. And in the end, they died together in the same room, in the same bed. And it's a shame and it hurts. But the beauty of the two always being together is something that it comforts us. It lets us know that they were with their best friends in the whole world. And it's like a book. It's like some kind of terrible chapter, but there's beauty in it. And we're going to get our justice. We're going to figure this stuff out. This community deserves that. And when I look at all you guys, there's only one way for this to get a little better, to heal a little bit. There's pain everywhere. Is you're just gonna have to love each other. You guys are just gonna have to hug each other. You're gonna have to be a little awkward. And you're just gonna have to share. And the only cure to pain is love. It's the only thing that's gonna heal us. That's the only thing that's gonna heal you. So all I challenge you in the next week, the next days, is just go out of your way and tell someone you love them. Love the people in your room that you go back to, your apartments, your house. And that will make a difference. And that's something that they can see where they're at right now. That you changed your life just a little bit. And you're a little bit nicer and a little bit kinder. Thank you.
I always feel like Steve Gonsalves just has a way with words. Like, I love listening to this man speak. I'm not gonna lie. Like, you could go through countless interviews with him and, man, it makes you feel something. So that was Kaylee's father. The next person I want to talk to you about is Zanna and her sister Jazzy. So at the vigil, Jazzy really spoke about Zanna and said that Zanna was the light in everyone's life, and she was a funny person who loved life and lived it to the fullest. Everyone enjoyed being around her, and she was extremely positive and lighthearted. She knew everyone and spoke to everyone, and she was always involved. She talked and smiled about Ethan, and for a while, Jazzy and her dad were afraid that Zanna was never going to get a boyfriend. But then she met Ethan, and anytime she talked about him, she just lit up. The two of them had something very special. And Jeff, her father, said that she was a mom to everyone, even to him sometimes, when she shouldn't have had to have been. But she was just that person, and she even got along with moms. Like, she just sounds like the cutest person ever. Zanna's aunt talked about her so fondly and talked about how they would go to get their nails done together once in a while and just how they would get to catch up, but recently had kind of like distanced because Zanna had a lot of, you know, college life going on and she was just experiencing life. But you could just tell how loved Zanna was. Her friends described her as unpredictable and fun. They said she was funny without even trying, and her friends felt significant and special when they were around her. You know, Kaylee's friends talked about her as well, and they said to know her was to love her. She was inspiring, and she went out of her way to make everyone feel loved and seen. Her one friend used a beautiful quote and said she embodied her own sun and her skies became limitless. I thought that was a beautiful quote. Ethan's friend came up and said that he was charismatic, tall, and athletic, and he was a great friend. He loved singing country music with his friend, and Zanna and Ethan were known to be a pair. Everybody knew they were a package deal. Ethan was always happy, and he was just a calm person who never got angry, never got upset. He was just extremely positive, and everyone loved him and especially loved his mustache. He would sing Moana songs with his friends as well, so Ethan sounded like a goofy, funny, really sweet kid. So, the next thing I'm going to tell you about is Dylan and Bethany. So, they have remained silent since the whole murder happened, and they both wrote letters to a pastor who shared them at that December 2022 service that I've been, you know, this memorial or vigil, whatever you want to call it. And we don't know much about where Bethany and Dylan were that night prior, and we don't know much about what happened to them after the murder. A little while after the murders, Dylan posted a photo to her Visco account, and she and Bethany got a tattoo in memory of their friends. And it's angel wings, similar to the ones that Maddie has. And inside of the angel wings, there's the first letter of each friend's name in the middle, M-K-X-E. And Dylan wrote the caption, "Maddie, Kaylee, Zanna, and Ethan, you were all gifts to this world in your own special way, and it just won't be the same without you." But because they weren't at the memorial service, they gave the pastor, or the priest, I'm sorry, forgive me if I have the wrong label, but I think they gave a letter to the priest, and the priest spoke to them because spoke for them because they weren't there, which I'm sure, I can't imagine how difficult it would be to go to a memorial service being Dylan or Bethany. You know, you were the only two who survived. Like, they were mourning. God knows what kind of processing that looked like, if there was any processing. But needless to say, this is what they had to say about their friends. Dylan said that Zanna and Ethan were two best friends, and they were the perfect pair. They were fun, passionate, crazy, and always had good energy, and they would help anyone. Zanna was always the life of the party. She was strong, intelligent, hardworking, and a people person. She could literally talk to anyone, and she loved moms. Ethan was sweet and loving to Zanna, and she was his whole world. Ethan was like a brother to Dylan, and he was sarcastic and funny. He was loving and cared about everyone, always easygoing and always easy to talk to. As for Maddie and Kaylee, they were two best friends who were like sisters. They were like moms to Dylan, and they taught Dylan how to be responsible, how to enjoy life to the fullest. Maddie was a cute ray of sunshine, never stressed over anything negative, never had a negative thought in her mind, and she was passionate and loved everyone. She was extremely compassionate and always wore her hot pink puffy jacket. She wore it everywhere, and she loved the color pink. She even had her pink cowboy boots in the window of her apartment. Maddie had really cute mannerisms. She had little dances and a little skip in her step. Kaylee was hardworking, driven, strong, and she worked for everything that she wanted. She even bought a Range Rover all on her own. She was a jokester and prankster. She was funny, And the four of them were Dylan's best friends who changed her life and made her so happy. As for Bethany, she said that the four were all one of a kind and they all lit up a room in different ways. Kaylee was funny, sweet, and giving and driven. She had a big smile and a big personality. Ethan had the brightest, most fun personality. He would walk into a room and the whole vibe would go up. His smile and laugh were contagious, and he was just such a good time, and he had so much love in his heart, especially for Zanna. She said Zanna was like no other. There was no one else out there like her. She was loving, fun, energetic, passionate, determined, and sweet. She was the life of the party and extremely charismatic. She got along with all types of people, and parents even loved her. She said Maddie was the sweetest and loving, and Bethany said that Maddie had so much love in her heart, and she always made people feel loved and special. Maddie was Bethany's big, and she gave the best advice and was always helpful. So yeah, they had some kind words to say about their friends. So oddly enough, Bethany was actually subpoenaed by Brian's defense attorney, Ann Taylor. Ann claimed that Bethany had exculpatory evidence as a witness, and this claim would have forced Bethany to actually testify as part of Brian's defense. Bethany's lawyer quickly fired back at Ann Taylor, claiming that her claim was without support. The filing from Bethany's attorney stated, "There is no further information or detail pertaining to the substance of this testimony, its materiality, or alleged exculpatory information of Ms. Funk, or why it would be entertained by the preliminary hearing." Brian's defense argued that Funk's testimony is the key to the trial and could clear the murder charges levied against Brian Koberger. And a criminal investigator in support of Brian's defense submitted an affidavit stating that Bethany Funk has information material to the charges against Mr. Koberger. Portions of information Ms. Funk has is exculpatory to the defendant. Ms. Funk's information is unique to her experiences and cannot be provided by another witness. So, this all stems from this tabloid that claimed that Bethany saw a naked man run out of the glass sliding doors of the house that night. However, this comes from an article from the Mirror, which is an unreliable source. However, if it was true, this could completely discount Dylan's account of that night. So who knows, but for whatever reason, the defense team thinks that Bethany knows something that would set Brian free. But here's the thing, Bethany's account of what happened that night has never been released to the public. Needless to say, in hopes of dropping the subpoena, Bethany and her attorney agreed to sit down with Brian's defense attorney for an interview, and we don't know the details beyond that. So much speculation has gone on, and we don't have all the information. We hear these tidbits of information, rumors, but it's mainly hearsay, predictions, lies, or false information. It has been really difficult to stick with the facts of this case, which makes it easy for people to make up stories. We as humans want things to make sense, so we'll try to bridge the gap where there is no information so we can make it make sense. So this is why social media has literally become the Wild West and you just can't believe everything you read or hear. So be careful with what you believe and be sure that you stick with the facts. We have more unknowns than knowns in this case and it's likely we're not going to hear any new information until the trial kicks off. But because Brian and his defense team are working hard to have no cameras allowed in the courtroom, who knows if we'll even get to peer into this trial, which I really hope we do. But I mean, I could see why they wouldn't want the cameras there, but I don't know what you guys think about that or what your take is. But right now, we're also waiting to hear when this new court date will be for the trial to start. We still don't know. And we don't know if cameras will be in the room, so stay tuned. I'm definitely going to give you all the updates as they come. I'll give like short little episodes, you know, describing whatever information comes out next. But I know these families want justice. I know everybody's super curious. So in the meantime, make sure you're keeping the facts, you know, straight in your head. Always check the facts. It's really easy to go down those rabbit holes. And I mean, sometimes it's entertaining because we just want answers, but we have to be careful not to spread wrong information or, you know, mislead the investigation. As for now, Brian Koberger is assumed innocent until proven guilty. If he is found guilty, he will be facing the death penalty. So friends, that is the Idaho 4 case. Let me know what your thoughts are. Go find me on social media. You could find me on TikTok, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, any social media platform you think of, I'm probably on it. But I would love to know what you guys think about this case and what your thoughts are and what kind of crazy conspiracy theories you've run into. But again, be careful. Remember what the facts are. This case has kept me up on countless nights, and I've been following very closely since November. I'm just dying to know all of the facts and the evidence, and, you know, I think we're all itching for this trial to start as soon as possible. I find it crazy, you know, with Brian, like, constantly claiming his innocence. It makes you wonder, do they have the right guy? Only time will tell. Until then, friends, check back often, see if there's updates. I'm going to be releasing new episodes, and, you know, I'm always open to case suggestions. Definitely go, you know, feel free to DM me about case suggestions or, you know, just overall thoughts about the podcast. Feel free to drop into the comments, as I always have pictures posted to Instagram of the case so you can reference them while listening. But other than that, I hope you guys stay safe. I hope you are back for next week's episode, and I can't wait to talk with you more. Have an amazing day, an amazing week, and I'll talk to you soon. Bye!